This is WUBUR.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. A little over 1,000 years ago, the world power of that era looked like it might remain dominant indefinitely. Islam had arrived. In Europe, in Africa, and across the East, the new religion was winning converts. And wherever that was contested, Muslims were winning the wars. In science and the arts and in social organization, Islam offered one of the most egalitarian worldviews of that time. However, today, the Muslim world does not share equally in the wealth, the technology, or the geopolitical influence much of the rest of the world enjoys. The historian Bernard Lewis asks the question why, with the title of his latest book, What Went Wrong? His answer is that Muslims need to place a lot of the blame on themselves. Connection listeners, this is a much debated and disputed issue. What did go wrong? And if you disagree with Professor Lewis's premise, tell us why. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bernard Lewis is Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He joins us this morning from a studio in Jerusalem. Hello, Professor Lewis.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. You're a long way from New Jersey.
I am indeed, yes.
Are you studying one of your regular jaunts in the Middle East?
Yes, I'm visiting several countries and trying to find out what I can about what's going on. I suppose I should add about what's going wrong.
I couldn't help but think about you this weekend as I was listening to the news from that region. I know you work as a historian. I know you work in the long view, but I also know that you're in the middle of a very dramatic place at this moment.
Indeed. History hasn't stopped yet, you know.
Do you see it as being in a place at a moment of possible change, or do you not view it that way?
I try to view it that way. I'm not sure with what measure of success. It's a different perspective. You know, I'm not a former statesman or government official. I have no secrets of state to reveal. I'm not a journalist, so I have no up-to-date scoops to offer. I'm a historian, which means that professionally I deal with the past. And I'm a retired historian, as you mentioned, so even my past is past, so to speak. But I try to keep up with what's going on and to view current events in a rather longer perspective. I think that's what historians have to offer.
Are you finding it a dangerous place to be now, just the drive from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem?
Well, I got here safely, without incident.
Let's talk about the book. Let's talk about what went wrong, or rather, let's go one step back before that and talk about what was going right before something went wrong. What was working so well in the Muslim civilization before, as you say, something went wrong?
Well, for a very long time, the Muslim civilization was the most advanced, the most creative, and therefore also the most powerful and the most wealthy in the world. It was the first civilization which one could describe as truly international. I mean, the civilizations of China, of India, of Europe were all, in a sense, local. A rather large locality, but still local. Muslim civilizations spanned Asia, Africa, and Europe. It brought together many different nations, many different races, in one common civilized endeavor. Because of the Muslim institution of the pilgrimage, which required every Muslim to go at least once in his life on pilgrimage to the holy places in Mecca and Medina, it developed a degree of personal mobility unknown in any previous civilization. In science, in mathematics, in physics, in astronomy, in anything else you choose to name, in manufactures and in trade, and of course in war, it was unchallenged. Muslim armies conquered across Africa into Spain and Sicily, even invading France, eastwards into Central Asia and invading India and China. Muslim manufacturers were sold all over the world. And then suddenly, so it seemed, things changed. Where they had previously always been victorious, they were suddenly now defeated. And they suffered setbacks not only in the battlefield, but also in the marketplace, when they were outperformed, shall we say, by Western merchants and Western manufacturers in the laboratories, in the sciences and in the arts. And the most dramatic and the most obvious illustration of this was defeat in war. That is, shall we say, the most perspicuous of the lessons of history. And just over 300 years ago, in 1699, the Ottoman Empire, then in the forefront of the Islamic world, was compelled for the first time to sign a peace treaty after a defeat, a peace treaty imposed by victorious enemies. And that started the debate which has been going on ever since, a debate which began among the military, political and intellectual elite of the Ottomans in the 18th century and has continued to embrace virtually the whole of the Islamic world. They ask, how is it that previously we were always triumphant, now we are always defeated? How is it previously we taught the infidels, now they have to teach us and we are asked to learn from them?
You make the point in the book several times that the different Islamic civilizations, the different all through what was at one point this great, I won't say the world empire, but Islamic world, people are consumed with their history. They study their history. They reflect on their history. They are more connected with their past in many ways than the Western civilizations. Accurate?
Yes, that is true. There is a strong sense of history. For example, from 1980 to 1988, there was a war between two neighboring Islamic countries, Iraq and Iran. In the war propaganda of both sides, addressed to their own populations and to the populations of their adversaries, there are frequent historical allusions, many allusions even to events of the 7th century. Not explanations, but just rapid, incomplete allusions to these events, which the propagandists could make in the sure knowledge that these allusions would be picked up and understood by their target audiences. Can you imagine anyone in America or even in Europe making a point of political propaganda by alluding to events of the 7th century? More recently, we have Osama bin Laden, in one of his statements, spoke with passion of the humiliation which we have been suffering, we meaning the Muslims, for more than 80 years, which sent, of course, everybody in the Western world scurrying to their history books. What's he talking about? What happened 80-odd years ago? His Muslim listeners and readers certainly knew exactly what he was talking about. I'm not saying that their history is more accurate, but certainly it is more detailed. They have a powerful awareness, consciousness of history, and of their place in an ongoing historical process.
So in that process, the question that you pose, what went wrong, and you widen that in later chapters to suggestion that the question could be who did this to us or why did we do this to ourselves? Why isn't that question then addressed all along? Your suggestion is that despite this fascination with the history, the Muslim nations have been unable to come to genuine terms with the answer to that question.
No, I'm not saying that. I say that the debate has been going on for a long time. It's not an easy question to answer. Remember, we are dealing not just with one battle or one country, but with a civilization and a period of centuries. There is a growing awareness, first of all, that something has gone wrong, and then an attempt to see what it is. It's a long debate. Many different answers are offered. There are no simple and easy answers to questions of this kind. But what I try to suggest in the book is that the answers have fallen broadly into two categories. When you become aware that something has gone wrong, the next question you can ask is, what did we do wrong? Which leads naturally to, how do we put it right? Or you can say, who did this to us? And that, unfortunately, leads to conspiracy theories and a twilight world of neurotic fantasies. We find both of these in the Islamic world. People who have tried to ascertain what they did wrong and how they can put it right, and people who look for scapegoats and various candidates for the blame game. We see both at the present time.
The people who criticize the title of the book, The Scholarship, say that the question itself is wrong, that for Bernard Lewis to say, to suggest that the question, what went wrong, is the way to address the disparity between East and West, is a somewhat pejorative approach.
I don't think anyone in the Islamic world would seriously dispute that things have gone wrong. They would attribute the blame in different ways. They would find different explanations. But that something has gone wrong is surely beyond dispute.
You don't think that there is an argument in the Islamic world that for someone to live in a village in Pakistan and basically, you know, manage the vegetables in the ground and the livestock and worship Allah and not measure success by, you know, New York stockbroker salaries and high buildings is a valid rejoinder to your question?
Oh, there are a lot of there are a lot of gradations between these two extremes. The peasant in Pakistan or any other Muslim country isn't greatly worried about skyscrapers and stockbrokers, but he cannot but be aware of the intrusive effect on his own society of this alien and advancing civilization. It goes under various names. Some people call it imperialism. Some people call it globalization. But the awareness of a growing disparity in strength and in wealth and in impact, influence between the two worlds is surely beyond dispute. One may disagree, indeed, people do disagree very strongly as to the causes and the remedies, but the fact surely is not in dispute. I mean, basically, at the present time, there are two diagnoses and two prescriptions. On the one hand, you have what you might call the modernists, who say we have fallen behind the modern world, we must catch up with it by modernizing our society. And on the other hand, you have those who say we went astray by imitating and aping the ways of the unbelievers and abandoning our own true Islamic principles and the way the prescription for this diagnosis is a return to authentic Islam. And that comes in a number of sub-varieties. But most of the answers, I think, fall into one or other of these two categories.
And are you finding that those answers to those questions are being debated even now as we speak?
Oh, yes, very much so. In those countries where free debate is possible, which is not, of course, all of them.
And is that conversation in any way related to what happened on September 11th?
September 11th didn't change anything in the realities. It did change something in the perceptions. But more, I think, in the perceptions in the Western world than among the Muslims themselves.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Bernard Lewis. We're talking about his new book, What Went Wrong? And you've heard a couple of the suggested questions and answers from the man himself. People in the Muslim world saying, we went astray. Perhaps we need to return to our roots. Others saying, we have fallen behind the modern world. We need to find a way to catch up. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us with your thoughts. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. This hour, my guest is Bernard Lewis, Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He's in a studio in Jerusalem, and we're talking about his book, What Went Wrong? Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response. Professor, I wanted to get you to talk a little bit about the mid-19th century, that moment when, or perhaps even a little bit before that, you can correct me, when the issue of people, simple people moving from the West to the East, the ease of travel, the ease of language, and you know, how at one point Muslim jurists weren't even sure whether or not it was right for Muslims to be living in a non-Muslim country, to be living among the infidels. Do you see that as a point where the gap started to widen?
Oh, that is certainly a major change. I mean, at one time, the general view of the Muslim jurists is that one cannot live a true Muslim life under an infidel government. So if a Muslim country had the misfortune to be conquered by non-Muslims, then it was the duty of Muslims to leave and go to a Muslim country, which is what happened, for example, to many of the Muslims of Spain when it was reconquered by the Christians. Some even went further and said that it was forbidden to visit non-Muslim countries. Obviously, that has changed. In the course of the 19th century, first they sent diplomats, then they sent student missions for the first time, and then, of course, inevitably, political refugees, people who got into trouble by proposing new and unacceptable ideas and sought refuge in European countries.
But as the printing press moved into Muslim countries and with them the newspapers and the journalists and, as you say, then the lawyers and the teachers, this right. didn't happen with the same sort of ease that it did in the West, because in many cases it was a theocracy trying to figure out how to manage all these different elements of influence.
I wouldn't call it a theocracy. I don't think Islamic government is a theocracy, at least not until the present republic in Iran. But it's certainly a government in which religious laws are very powerful and their professional upholders have a great role. Now, the printing press is a good example. The printing press was certainly known. The introduction of printing in Europe is mentioned in the Ottoman Chronicles of the time. Not only that, but the non-Muslim minorities in the Muslim state were allowed to use them. First the Jews, then the Christians, Greeks and Armenians and others, introduced printing presses and printed their own literature for their own use, while the Muslim majority simply refused to have printing or printing press until the 18th century, sometime later. And then, even then, it was with great difficulty and against serious obstacles. In Iran, it didn't come till still later. So the difficulties in the way of introducing the printing press are a good illustration. But when it came, the impact was enormous. You had the printing press, and then, of course, as a result of that, you had the newspaper. You first get newspaper people in numbers coming to the Middle East during the Crimean War. They came as war correspondents, and some of them also took on additional assignments for local newspapers. And for the first time, you get daily newspapers. And then the development of the newspaper press in all the languages of the Middle East was very rapid, and its impact was quite enormous. And it created an entirely new figure, the journalist, a very portentous figure in the development of the modern Middle East. You also mentioned the lawyer. Well, in the traditional society, the only law was Sharia, the holy law of Islam. The reformers tried to modernize by introducing European or European-style codes of law, commercial law, criminal law, civil law, and others. And this meant the emergence of a new profession, the lawyer, who is concerned just with the law and not simply the holy law, which was the purview of the jurists. So there again you have an important new profession, journalists and lawyers, and of course with the creation of new political institutions, you get the politician as well. And this is a long way towards embracing at least the institutions of the modern world.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Boston, Nasser is joining us. Hello, Nasser.
Good morning, gentlemen. Professor Lewis, I had the pleasure of talking with you a couple of years ago on the very specific question of what went wrong.
Yes.
This time, I just want to bring you a little more. I'm from Pakistan, and in high school, it occurred to me, because I was interested in sciences, that the scientific revolution did not take place in non-Western countries. And I started to look into that question for the last 20 to 30 years, and there's only one reference I could find was Professor Sabra, I.E. Sabra from Harvard University, who has mentioned very briefly, and I I have been very lucky to make acquaintance with him and develop friendly relationship with him.
What, yes, I knew him well.
A nice gentleman.
Yes,
the question is this. Number one, there's a saying by Francis Bacon that when he looked at the Arabic translated scientific books, he declared, we are going to take this scientific knowledge and conquer the world. That's one. In your opinion, what is this which can point to us why the scientific revolution did not take place in non-Western civilization, and specifically in Islamic civilization?
Nasser, thanks for your question.
Yep.
Bernard Lewis.
Yes, I think that is one of the central issues. In the great age of Islamic civilization, as I'm sure you are aware, the Islamic world was in the forefront in virtually all fields of scientific activity, in medicine, biology, chemistry, astronomy, physics, mathematics. The West, Europe in particular, were the pupils of the Islamic world. And then suddenly the great change occurred. Europe advanced, and the Islamic world, instead of keeping pace as one might have expected, fell behind. In my book, I illustrate this by two examples. One is the pulmonary, the lesser circulation of the blood, a major discovery in the history of medicine, which transformed the whole practice and perception of medical science. Now, this is usually attributed to a 16th century Spanish physician, Miguel Cerveto. And true, he wrote about this, and it was incorporated in the whole body of scientific medicine. Cerveto came to a bad end. He was executed for heresy in Geneva. His teaching, his doctrine of this circulation of the blood was anticipated by several centuries by a 13th century Syrian physician called Ibn Nafis, who wrote a book setting forth in great detail the pulmonary circulation of the blood. The difference was that Ibn Nafis's book remained in manuscript and remained unknown until it was discovered by a German orientalist in modern times, whereas Cerveto's rediscovery became part of modern science. So the creative power was there. One has to ask not the lack of science, but what was there about the society which prevented it from accepting and making use of the work of its scientists. Another example, if I may, in astronomy. In the 16th century, there were two major observatories in Europe, one in Denmark, one in Istanbul. And from what we know, they had very similar equipment and very similar observations and very similar findings. The one in Denmark became the basis of modern astronomic science. And the one in Istanbul was destroyed by a squad of Janissaries with an order from the Chief Mufti. There were no more observatories after that until modern times. Here again you have the science was there, the scientists were there, but the society somehow rejected them. That is, I think, the question which one has to ask, and it's not an easy question to answer. But I don't think the answer is in science. Science is part of the question.
Nasser, I'm just wondering, in your own perspective, because you've obviously thought about this, whether or not you see the East as having been dramatically left behind by the way that the West was able to take advantage of its inventions and creations.
Well, I tell you, as I mentioned to you, I have spent a lot of time at MIT and Harvard looking into this question. It was kind of my hobby. I'm a practicing scientist, and I teach at the moment in local university. I have looked into this idea from a variety of angles, from artificial intelligence courses I've taken at MIT and neuroscience courses I've taken at MIT, just to understand how does brain perceives the knowledge the way it does, even though we have the same type of brain. I have some answers to it, but it is a kind of too elaborate scientifically to describe this on the radio.
Nasser, let's let Bernard Lewis back in.
Would you agree with me that the question is not really one of science but of society? The scientists were still there, the intelligence, the ability was still there, but the society somehow was unable or unwilling to make use of it.
I agree society comes first, but I think the science is right with it. It's a combination of the two. If the science... No, I have a scientific proof, actually. I have come up with a scientific proof why things went wrong the way it did, but I cannot divulge it right now.
And we'll wait for your book then, Nasser.
I hope so.
A number of people who are trying to get in, so I'm going to move along to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Coder is joining us on the phone. Hello.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good show. How are you, Mr. Lewis?
Hello.
Okay. My question is, how would you blame the political institutions and the political establishment in the Muslim world to their fall falling behind the West?
I don't like the word blame. I think one sees a number of complex interacting developments affecting each other in various ways. If you use the word blame, it suggests some sort of culpability, and I don't think that's a helpful approach. Political institutions are part of a larger complex of institutions. The traditional political institutions obviously worked very well since they functioned during the great age of Islamic civilization. But then something went wrong with them, as with everything else. And this is a sort of chicken and egg proposition. It's very difficult to say which and where. These are both causes and consequences. Now, one difference in the political institutions was a loss of freedom. By this, I don't mean to say that medieval Islamic society was free, as we use that word at the present time. But it was a good deal freer than in later times, because modernity strengthened authority. It put weapons, means of surveillance and repression, in the hands of governments, which governments in earlier times did not possess. It also restricted or even abolished the intermediate powers of various kinds, which in traditional Muslim society had limited the authority of government. Any modern dictator in the Middle East exercises far greater power and control over his subjects than even the greatest of the caliphs and sultans of the past.
Exactly. Well, the sultans in the past, as you well know, provided for their subjects. Today's leaders do not, and actually their wealth is in Europe, not in the Middle East.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My guest is Bernard Lewis. He's the author of What Went Wrong? Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response. Mr. Lewis, just a response to Coder's point that the money, whether it's from Saudi Arabia or any of the Muslim world where that access to fossil fuel is so strong, is being moved off to Europe, and whether or not that's a part of the answer to the question.
Yes, a lot of the money is certainly being moved to what they regard as safer places. That doesn't help, but I think, again, there's a difficulty of disentangling cause from consequence. They move the money to other places because they don't think it would be safe or productive at home. So why do they reach that conclusion? One goes back step by step, to question.
You make the point at one point in your book that if you take away the wealth earned by fossil fuels, and add together the exports of the Arab world, am I right in remembering that it comes up to about the same as the exports from Finland?
That is a World Bank figure, yes. If you eliminate fossil fuels, the total exports of the Arab world are about the same as those of Finland, a country of 5 million inhabitants. I think in the long run, one will have to decide that the discovery of oil was a curse to the Arab lands, not a blessing.
1-800-423-8255. Coder, thanks for your call. We're going to Lexington, Massachusetts, and Joelle is on the line. Hi, Joelle.
Hello, and hello, Dr. Lewis. I'm glad to
hear
you.
Hello, Joelle.
I have 2 points, and they may be simplistic compared with what you are talking about and what's been said. But the first is, in the matter of something going wrong, it seems to me that all civilizations eventually, or all empires, eventually fall. Things do come apart, and the Islamic Empire, of course, did. I think we are in the process of doing the same, and one of the signs of it is frequently a loss of freedom. and an increasing militarization and authoritarianism.
We're in the process, meaning the United States is in the process, Joelle?
Yes, or Western civilization may well be in that process. I'm not saying it absolutely is. But I don't see this as, you know, I don't see infinite hegemony as possible. It seems to me that history shows that things always fall apart and other societies or peoples do overtake. They learn and then they exceed frequently.
Joelle, you had said you had 2 points. Let's take them one at a time. Let me let Bernard Lewis in now.
Which is your first point? Could you clarify that, please?
Just that all empires or civilizations eventually fail.
Yes, yes. I think one should distinguish between empires and civilizations.
Okay.
Empires, yes, come to... I beg your pardon?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I think one should distinguish between empires and civilizations. One can have one without the other. There have been empires which were uncivilized and civilizations that were not imperial. But yes, there is a natural law of growth, maturity, decay, and death. And that, I think, is no reason why we shouldn't continue to examine the processes and try to understand them.
Joelle, back to you.
I have a second point. Is it possible to make it?
Yes, please.
All right. I think that in the question of where did we do wrong versus who did this to us and looking for blame, the dangerous thing is to decide that somehow we have a manifest destiny and we are the only people who should be getting ahead or getting back what we lost. And I don't think this is at all peculiar, again, to Islamic people. I think the Jews have done very much the same thing in Israel. And it is a great tendency. I think, I'm not anti-Israel, but I think it's a dangerous kind of thinking, and it leads people toward chauvinism and toward feeling other people are less worthy than themselves.
Joelle, I'm going to take your question and ask Bernard Lewis to answer it when we come back after our break, because we do have to step away for just a couple of moments here. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, Bernard Lewis, his book, What Went Wrong, Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest is Bernard Lewis. Just prior to the break, Joelle was with us with a question, and I'm going to try and paraphrase Mr. Lewis if you think I may have it a little bit wrong. It's in effect, in the search for answers that we do get lost in looking for blame and in a way then start to use our own values to judge others. Is that an accurate paraphrasing of Joelle's last question?
Oh, well, I think she was rather more specific than that.
Go ahead, then.
She referred in particular to the question of Israel and of relatively small national groups. We've been talking about something on a very large scale, civilizations and empires. And I think it can only confuse things if we go to the level of individual nations and countries and individual groups within those nations and countries. Those are also certainly important and necessary to study, but I don't think they're useful as a point of comparison for considering the rise and fall of civilizations.
You are, though,
you
are a student of Israel, and one of the points that you make in the book is that for 14 centuries, Jews lived without a homeland of their own. So when they came together in Israel, they brought with them the Judeo-Christian culture and the Judeo-Islamic culture, and that in watching Israel, we can perhaps learn something about the way that those two cultures intersect or don't intersect.
Yes. May I elaborate on that point, then?
Please.
The point I try to make is this. Christendom and Islam, or Islamdom, if you wish to call it that, are civilizations, not just religions, of vast extent. Judaism is a religion, a religious culture. It is not a civilization. it has been a component, in particular, of two civilizations. Nowadays, we often use the term the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's an old reality, but a new term, which in earlier times would have been equally resented on both sides of the hyphen. We could, with equal justification, talk of a Judeo-Islamic tradition. Jews lived principally in two civilizations, the Christian and the Islamic, and were part of both, a subculture, if you like, of both. Now, in the modern state of Israel, and this is what is particularly interesting for the historian of civilizations, in the modern state of Israel, you have Jews who come from both. You have Jews who come from Europe and America, who bring with them a great deal of the Christian, or if you like, the Judeo-Christian civilization from which they come. And you have also Jews who come from Iran, from the Arab countries, from North Africa, who also bring with them much of the Islamic civilization. So in a civilizational, as distinct from a religious sense, you have the two civilizations in this one small country with a shared religion, a shared territory, and a shared state allegiance. And I have no doubt that a good deal of the internal divisions within Israel, which are sometimes ascribed to European versus Oriental or Ashkenazic versus Sephardic, are instead really reflections of the larger encounter between the Christian and Islamic civilizations, from the two of which the Jewish populations in Israel have largely come.
And in your view, is the reconciliation of those two different perspectives in any way instructive to the larger picture that we've been talking about?
If the reconciliation is achieved, it will certainly be instructive.
Are we getting there?
There are signs of progress, but there are still signs of, shall we say, conflict. I mean, there are two different sets of cultural values which often meet. One sees it in many small things as well as some large ones. And in this sense, one might describe modern Israel as a sort of small-scale experiment in Christian-Muslim cohabitation.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Dave, who's calling in from Merrimack, New Hampshire. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hello. Good.
Good. First of all, I'd like to say that this is quite a coincidence because just this weekend I bought the book that you're talking about and read it, and then much to my surprise, there was this wonderful radio program about it. So I'm very happy with that.
Thank you.
Also, I enjoyed the book. My reaction to the book was that if I were to write a book, which I'm not going to do, I would write it. Rephrase the question as what went right, in the sense of what went right in Europe. It's not clear at all clear to me that anything went wrong in the Islamic civilization. And over the years, I've found a very great historical mystery in why in the world Europe did the Renaissance. I mean, there's a lot of different, sort of explanations to this. But they did the Renaissance, and the Europeans developed the idea of progress, the idea that the future may not resemble the past, and that the future may even be better than the past. And I think that idea, when you really think about it, is terribly frightening to people who have a more cyclical view of history, which I think was the view of practically everyone before the Renaissance. And in fact, the struggle that we see today is not just the struggle in the Middle East. From my point of view, the individual that shoots a doctor that works in a woman's clinic in Buffalo, New York, is fighting the same battle as the person that flies an airliner into the World Trade Towers. They're both adherence to a closed religious canon that says, I know what the world is all about and progress is impossible.
Let's let Bernard Lewis answer, David.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with you part of the way. I think you make an important point, Dave. It is true that if one looks and compares the development of Christendom and Islam in the last few centuries, one has to ask also not only what did they do wrong, but what did Christendom do right? And indeed, this question has been asked and answered in various ways within the Muslim world. In the debate in the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, it very often took the form of, what are they doing right that we are doing wrong, and how can we change that? But it isn't only a comparison of these two, and more recently, people in the Muslim world have also begun to compare themselves with, say, East Asia, with Japan, with China, with other non-Western societies. One may say that the sudden advance of the West is something unique and must be attributed to causes within the West. But other non-Western societies have been able to catch up and participate to the full, Japan and increasingly China and India, in a way that the Islamic world has so far not been able to do. And this has posed an even more agonizing question, which is being hotly debated in Muslim countries.
Oh, yes, I remember reading in your book when you made that point. And again, I would say that the reason that those countries, for example, Japan's a wonderful example, have been quote-unquote successful, is that they have embraced this idea of progress. They've embraced the idea that, in fact, the future does not necessarily have to resemble the past. And I think that for people who are very wedded to a particular religious view, whether they be Christian, Jew, or Muslim, that idea is the most frightening idea that you could possibly conceive of. And it results in an enormous amount of violence in the world, both in this country and in the Middle East and anywhere else in the world where this kind of conflict, and from my point of view, it is like the conflict of the modern world. And in fact, from my point of view, it's symptomatic that the modern world is still being born.
Which I think that goes to the point that Bernard Lewis was making earlier in the program, in that there are two streams of thought in the Muslim world looking for an answer to the question, what went wrong? And one stream is, we strayed from our ways and we need to go back.
Right. I would say that the ideas of progress and development are not alien to Islamic thought. The question is precisely how.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Dave, thanks for your call. We're going next to Jamaica Plain. Carol is on the line. Hi, Carol.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I think one thing has been left out, and I'm very surprised it has been, and that is the illiteracy of the women in those countries. You cannot build a society without good, tuned-in, educated women who are educating the children and bringing them, and even getting them ready for reading. It takes an enormous amount of skill, an enormous amount of intelligence, and I'm just surprised it hasn't been mentioned at all. I'll take my answer off the air if I can, please.
Well, Carol, thanks for calling up and bringing it to the table. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest is Bernard Lewis. Bernard Lewis, go ahead.
Thank you very much for raising that question. It's one to which I give considerable importance in my book. Visitors from east to west and from west to east are constantly drawing attention to the differences between the two. And one which they virtually all notice is the difference in the treatment of women. In the Western world, the Christian rule of monogamy was observed. I won't say it was always practiced, but at least one was only entitled to one legal wife, or one at a time. In the Islamic world, as in many other places, polygamy and concubinage were customary, and that inevitably lowered the status of women. Most Muslim visitors to the pre-modern West express utter astonishment at what they regard as the excessive respect and regard given to women. And from about the mid-19th century onwards, you get serious discussion. The earliest example known to me is a Turkish writer called Namık Kemal, who wrote an article, I don't recall the exact date, but in the 1850s, in which he sees the principal cause of the relative backwardness of the Muslim world as the subjection of women. He says, how can we hope to keep up with the modern world if we deprive ourselves of the services of half our population and subject the other half, the upbringing of the other half, to illiterate and downtrodden mothers? He uses two striking images. He says, at best, we treat our women like jewels or musical instruments. And then he says, because of the way we treat women, our society is like a human body that is paralyzed on one side. For a long time, there was very little response to that, but it was taken up again in a rather vigorous form by Kemal Atatürk, the founder and first president of the Turkish Republic, who started a vigorous campaign in the 1920s for political rights for women. Anything less likely at first sight than an Ottoman Pasha and a general campaigning for women's rights would be difficult to imagine. But that's precisely what he did. And he gave his reasons in his usual terse and clear way. He said, our present task is to catch up with the modern world. We shall not catch up with the modern world if we only modernize half the population. And this remains a big issue. Khomeini, for example, saw the emancipation, in quotes, of women as a major reason for what he regarded as Western depravity and corruption.
Coincidentally, I'm sorry, I was just going to say that, coincidentally, I was reading a book over the weekend by the Moroccan writer Fatima Mernissi, who was citing statistics for how Muslim women in Egypt, in a number of Islamic countries, are moving in with great speed into the world of the sciences and the universities, and that that, in fact, may be a large part of the turnaround.
That is probably the best hope for the future. As was pointed out, they are half the population, the hitherto suppressed half. When I was teaching, I found that my women students from Muslim countries were often very good as compared, better than male students, for two simple reasons. One, they had to be extremely good in order to get there at all. And another was that being women, they were not subjected to the systematic brainwashing that passed for traditional education.
Bernard Lewis, I want to thank you for taking this time to be with us.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
Bernard Lewis, Professor Emeritus, Near Eastern History at Princeton University. And the title of his book is What Went Wrong? If you're in the Boston area, you should know that Professor Lewis will be speaking at the Harvard Graduate School of Education on the 8th of April. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugarts. Our intern is Jill Teitelman. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.